Welcome to Inside Pop. I'm Amita Patel. I saw Wonder Woman and I'm feeling invincible.
And I'm Sean David Johnson. This week we are talking all about the girl power that took over the box office and Amita's personality. Also the latest Sense8 news, sob, sniff, and we discuss the potential fate of Master of None.
Plus, we revisit one of our favorite interviews with the writer, producer, and director of the documentary Tickling Giants.
That's a lot, but you deserve more, so we're also giving you the big sell. All up ahead on Inside Pop.
Okay, I am feeling so excited to talk about Wonder Woman. I saw it this past weekend. It was awesome. It's exactly what I wanted it to be. It was fun. It was filled with action. Gal Gadot kicked butt, and it kicked butt at the box office too. I was pleasantly surprised to see that it made over $100 million in the U.S., which is a new record for a female-directed film. Girl power.
That is awesome news all around. For so many years, the industry, fans, fanboys have said, you know what? People don't want to go see a woman in an action film leading the way. And they cited things like Catwoman and Elektra. And I think what the lesson is that we've learned is if it's a great film, people will see it. It will make a lot of money. And it was interesting. I read, Amita, that the box office was really almost evenly split. It was something like 52% women, 48% men. So it was kind of right down the middle.
Yeah, I saw that too. And I also saw that it beat films like the opening weekend for Iron Man, the opening weekend for Thor, and the opening weekend for Doctor Strange. Sisters doing it for themselves.
Well, I am going to blow up your spot and tell our listeners that this morning at work, it was Monday morning, so Amita was fresh off of Wonder Woman. She shows up, she walks over to my desk. She is standing, I believe the phrase is arms akimbo. Is that when you stand like this? She was standing, I'm not exaggerating this. First of all, she takes off her jacket. She's wearing a golden necklace, bare arms, standing with her fists on her hips. She is feeling the Wonder Woman vibes, and she was ready to share it with everyone.
It was not intentional. I was really just ready to get some work done. But yes, I appreciated the compliment that I was emulating Wonder Woman. Sure.
You were serving Diana Prince realness.
If I can do that every day, I would love to try. So kudos, congratulations, Patty Jenkins, the director, Gal Gadot, the entire cast of Wonder Woman. It was smart. It had moments of humor and great action. I highly recommend it. It also just has all the things that you want for a summer blockbuster. So it's not just meant for girls. It is meant for guys. It's meant for anybody who really enjoys a great summer blockbuster film, in my opinion.
Hey, that's me. I haven't seen it yet, but I really want to. So perhaps next weekend I will check it out. Well, let's turn our attention to some television, if you can call Netflix television. I'll call it television. Let's turn our attention to some Netflix television news. So it's no surprise to anyone that you, Amita Patel, have been enjoying the second season of Master of None. It should also not be a surprise to listeners that I have also been enjoying this wonderful show. So we have been savoring it, sort of, right? We're not binging it. We've been watching a couple of episodes a week, maybe a little bit more than that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, but it's so good. Yeah. So good. Great. I've already said it, and spoiler alert for anybody, not a spoiler of Master of None, just a spoiler on this podcast. It's going to be on my top 10 of the year. I'm just going to say it right now. Like, I think, surpassed already a great first season with the second season, in my opinion. They really just upped their game with the way that they've crafted these episodes. I'm not done yet, but I'm so in love with the series.
Yeah, and there are really standout episodes. And I think that the episodes that I immediately want to talk about are the ones that are that feel out of the box.
Yeah.
So, for example, Thanksgiving, which is this wonderful episode, which tells the story of really of Dev and Denise, but it's really Denise's story. And the you revisit Denise with her family on Thanksgiving every few years from childhood to the present. And it's really beautiful and funny and touching. And it's something that, you know, it's interesting. I've read a lot of articles with Alan Yang and Aziz Ansari. And one of the things that they always talk about is listening to each other and listening to other people while they're writing, right? Which in some ways is very different from, I think, a lot of television writers who, and writers in general, the voices come from inside and they're writing about. But I think, you know, you can tell that Aziz Ansari and Alan Yang sat down with the actress who plays Denise and asked her about her life and asked her about what coming out was like. And it's there in every single line of dialogue, in every single moment in that Thanksgiving episode.
Yeah, you really hit, I think, what I feel this season encapsulates more than last season is just this reality. And it sounds so weird to say it, but it is, it has such real and, in the best way possible, regular moments, you know, like just that conversation that he has with Denise about coming out. And then they may just like crack a joke and it's awkward and then it's funny and then it's just nothing sometimes, just hanging out. And it's like real. It's a real conversation. It's a real friendship. You know, I think you feel that. You feel you could relate to it a lot more than some other stuff that you might see.
And I would say that unlike Seinfeld, which, you know, they kind of made a joke, but also very, in a very genius-like way, made very funny stuff about nothing, right? That was their catchphrase. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think what you're describing is in those casual, what seem like everyday moments, they're saying a lot and it's about everything.
Right. And it doesn't feel as produced in some ways, even though it is. It doesn't, because they create such a sense of realism in these guys, in their lives, you know. And I think some of that comes from the fact that it's not all about Dev, the main character. You know, there is episodes he's not even in, which is pretty cool.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that we are, like many other people, enjoying it quite a bit, which the most recent news has hit us a little hard. It's made us a little nervous. And that news is basically when Aziz Ansari was at the Vulture Festival, you know, he said that he and Alan Yang spent a long time creating season two, and they were basically writing about what they had experienced. After season one, they went off and they lived their lives, and the lives that they lived resulted in what a layered, nuanced, wonderful season. And he's basically said that he doesn't have any additional stories to tell on Master of None right now. So he's not guaranteeing a third season at all. He's not saying, he's not promising that a third season is going to come soon.
Yeah, he actually says that season three, the words of it stress him out. And he loves what he did, and he said he made a show with his best friend and his whole entire immediate family, and I think that's adorable when he has his parents in the episode. But Aziz basically said, you know, they want to keep the bar high, right? That's kind of what he's saying. He's like, he wouldn't want to do a third season if it wasn't as inspired as what they did. And frankly, I don't think any of us want a third season unless it is as inspired as what they've already done. So I appreciate that. It sucks to know that there is a big question mark on this series that I do enjoy, but I really respect the fact that he wants to step back. He needs to live his life. He needs to find more stories to be able to tell more stories. And it comes from a place, a very natural place for him. Like, this is taken from his life and Alan Yang's life, and they want to be able to live life to be able to tell these stories, which I love.
Well, at least as fans of Master of None, we do have a glimmer of hope that maybe in a year or 2 years or 3 years or even 5 years, there might be another season of Master of None. Sadly, for myself, being a Sense8 fan, the news is much more definitive and much more grim. Netflix announced this past week that Sense8 will not continue, and that season 2, which is a season I'm continuing to savor, I have not finished it yet, will be its final season. So that news obviously hit me hard. And first of all, shout out to all of my friends on Twitter, including JojCast and Wendell Britt of the Tone podcast, who reached out to see if I was okay. Because the answer is no, I was not okay. So thank you for your support. But Amita, yeah, it's horrible news, especially because, and this is the interesting thing, Netflix has not been in the business of canceling shows. I think Netflix has been in the business of greenlighting lots of shows and keeping those shows on the air. And I think their strategy was just the more content, whatever, for whatever reasons, the smarter business it was, because the more content they had, the more original programming, the higher their subscription rates would go. But Sense8 canceled. And Sense8's not the only show. You know, they also announced that they canceled The Get Down.
Right.
Earlier this year, was it at the end of last year, we found out that Bloodline was not going to continue past its current season. So there are shows now being canceled. The frustrating thing about Netflix is, for anyone like you or I who care about dissecting and analyzing pop culture, they do not release their ratings. So we don't know.
Right.
Whether, you know, how popular or unpopular Sense8 was.
Yeah. And I just felt like the news came slightly suddenly just because they just released season 2. So it gave me kind of a feeling of like traditional network TV, because if something doesn't fly when a new, you know, a season of a show or a debut of a show comes out in a couple weeks, they could get the axe. And this sort of felt a little like that. But Netflix isn't known for that. So it was very interesting to hear just a month after the second season debuted that they're like, see you later.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm sure part of the decision had to be because it was a very expensive show to make. They filmed on multiple continents in dozens of cities. And I think the reviews, especially for season 2, were much stronger. So I think they were happy to have a well-reviewed, prestigious show. I mean, it was Michael J. Straczynski and the Wachowski sisters. But yeah, it just didn't, I think, have that combination. It didn't have the buzz of an Orange is the New Black or House of Cards. It probably didn't have those ratings. So yeah, so I think, and I know that there's some type of campaign online to bring it back. But I'm, you know what? I'm just going to accept the reality, all good things, and just really enjoy these last few episodes I have left, and also probably rewatch it. I'll probably come back to it in the way I come back to things like Battlestar Galactica and Buffy, and just, you know, it's definitely kind of up there in shows that I'm sure I will enjoy watching a repeated number of times spread out over the years. So RIP Sense8, you were wonderful and rare, and you felt like a show made just for me, and for that, I shall always remember ye.
Pouring some out for Sense8.
And that orgy scene, though. Okay.
Oh, my God. That orgy scene, though. That, I don't watch this series, but I was enlightened to that.
I'm going to tell it like it is. There is actually a very erotic, super sexy orgy scene with all 8 Sense8s and their respective partners. There were a lot of people involved in this orgy scene. And I showed it to Mita. Comma, at work, period.
There's people at work that might hear this.
You know what? I ain't ashamed, kind of.
Oh my God.
Amita, let's keep it classy and change topics. Right now, we want to take a listen to a wonderful interview that Amita conducted a few months ago with Sarah Taxler. She is the writer, director, and producer of a wonderful documentary called Tickling Giants. Let's take a listen.
Let's just get started and discuss, what is Tickling Giants about?
Tickling Giants is the story of this guy named Bassem Youssef, who a lot of people have seen when he's been on The Daily Show a few times. And he's an Egyptian guy who was a heart surgeon and during the Arab Spring decided to make a comedy show with his friend. And it wound up being one of the biggest comedy shows ever in the history of television. And he had 30 million viewers per episode versus a show like The Daily Show, which had about 2 million per episode under Jon Stewart. And the show really took off. And then the movie is about his fight for free speech in a country where free speech is not settled law. So not everyone agrees that you should be allowed to make jokes about politics and the president and religion and government. And so the story follows how Bassem and his team try to find creative and nonviolent ways to fight for free speech and also to stop a president who abuses his power.
This all sounds eerily familiar right now, Sarah.
I know. When I was making it, I had no idea that it would be this relevant in the U.S. I could not have imagined. Yeah, so I've obviously watched the movie 1,000 times, and then now I try to not watch it too much unless I'm at a screening so that it can be fresh again for me and I can try to pick up new things. And when I watched the movie right after the election, I hadn't seen it in a few months, and we were at a film festival, and someone in a comment after the screening said, "This is a warning for the U.S. that this, you know, this is what could happen here." And this was the election. Trump wasn't president yet, but I can't believe some of it is happening now in terms of the press and also just in terms of the people in this movie. Some of them have left the country of Egypt because it wasn't safe to speak freely, or my cinematographer couldn't be a documentary filmmaker in Egypt anymore. There, you know, there's a lot of creative people who can't do their jobs or live their lives freely, at least the way they'd like to. And some of the people who worked on the movie, like my assistant editors, are political refugees in the U.S. And now I'm like, these are the kinds of people we're talking about when we talk about a Muslim ban or things like that. Like, yeah, you know, fun, just nice, funny, normal people. And it's crazy that now in my country, this is an issue also.
Yeah. When we spoke in August, we were saying, I was like, I hope you get this movie out. I hope you get distribution and you can get it out before the election. It seems so topical for that. And I don't think that you or I ever thought that Trump would win. And then the sequence of events of the last 2 months, for now to think that this is even more relevant now.
Yeah, exactly. I actually wrote an email a few days after the inauguration to a guy I've become friends with, who's one of the people in the movie. And I just asked him for advice. And I was like, how do you deal with this? Like, you know, his country didn't feel quite so off his kilter either until 5 years ago. And and so he was just basically like, all these things existed. You just didn't know they were there. And now you're aware of it. And you can either be overwhelmed and not participate, or if you can figure out how to articulate yourself and what you think is important, you can be part of the discourse. And so I'm trying to keep that in mind and be like, yeah, okay, America is great and screwed up in a lot of ways. And it was before, I just didn't know it because I wasn't one of the people who was targeted by those things that were screwed up. Right. And now I know it. And I mean, like a lot of people, it's overwhelming to figure out what to do. But for me, Tickling Giants isn't just the movie title. It's like what I hope people will do with the information. So obviously throughout our history, culturally, there are like musicians and artists and people who speak out about civil injustice through creative ways, and whether it's telling jokes or writing a song or whatever else. And so like, I want people to think about that in terms of what they could do in their own lives. So how could you be tickling giants in your own world, like big or small? It doesn't have to be the president or the government, like in your own day-to-day life, like who's taking advantage and how can you find a creative way to stop that from happening?
Definitely. I mean, I think that you found your creative way in this film right now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's sometimes when I'm feeling overwhelmed by all of it, I'm like, well, hopefully when people see the movie, there'll be some little change that happens for them, or feel a little bit inspired or comforted or motivated to do something.
Yeah, I know I did. I definitely was when I saw this. So I would love to talk to you a little bit about like producing the film. You know, for a little bit of background on Sarah, she is a senior producer at The Daily Show here in New York. So you've been there for years, and that is how you met Bassem, right?
Right. Yeah. So I've been at The Daily Show since 2005. And in 2012, Bassem and his team came to observe our show before they went live before a studio audience. And in my memory, I don't ever remember having anyone else come in just for the purpose of observing us. And so it was fun. Everyone was like, "Oh, who are these guys? Like, what are they up to?" And Bassem is a very charismatic guy. And the first thing that I found really intriguing was, "Oh, this guy has to do what we do every day, but with such higher stakes." And at the time, it was impossible for me to imagine having a president who would try to stop you from making a joke or something like that. And so I was really curious about that. And then, so we all started talking, and two of the producers who came with him are women. And a lot of times people ask me, what's it like to be a woman working in comedy? And I was just really curious what it would be like to be my counterpart in Egypt. And I had my own preconceived notions that turned out to be incorrect. Like, the office is very split between men and women, and women being involved creatively and in production. But anyway, so we were all talking, and then I was debating whether I should ask them if I could make a documentary because I just loved the story, but it was so impulsive. Like, I'd met them a couple hours earlier, and I was trying to convince a friend at work that he should go with me to Egypt, and he was like, "No way, I have my own stuff going on." And then I was just like, "I don't want to let the opportunity pass." And I had recently been dumped, so I think leaving the country felt like a very genius idea. And I was just debating a bunch of stuff, and so I went up to Bassem at the end of the first day, and I asked if I could make a movie about him, and he was like, "Sure." And then I was just like, "What have I done?
That's incredible,
I'm
though.
scared." It was, and he, I mean, I think neither of us knew what that meant because the show wasn't the huge hit it later became. We didn't know how big the story would become. But then I sat on it for a while because I was scared to go, and the U.S. State Department wasn't encouraging travel that wasn't absolutely necessary.
Right. This is back
And
in
then
June 2012, right?
in 2012, and then a few months later, Bassem was called in for questioning about jokes he had made about the president. And I just thought that was outrageous. And I was like, "I have access to this story." And I felt like I could do justice to the story. And so I called him again. I called Bassem again and just said, "This time I'm serious. Can I make a movie?" And he said, "Yes." I hired a local crew to start filming, and then started making trips there.
So I guess that I'd love to dive deeper into that. Like, you just made trips to Egypt. That, first of all, it's not that easy to do. And how are you able to balance that whilst working on The Daily Show and having a full-time job and then being there for enough time to capture what you needed to capture to piece this documentary together?
Well, so there are a bunch of steps to it. One was the crew started filming before I'd ever even been there, so I didn't know what to suggest. And then I was supposed to go there, and then the political climate wasn't great, and Boston's publicist suggested I wait. She didn't think it was a good time for me to make my first trip. So they were still filming, but I hadn't been there yet. So it was sort of just random filming without a focus because I didn't know what my story would be. And then I went over there for a few weeks, and I actually had a great experience. Like, some of it was kind of overwhelming because I was a woman and I was by myself, and I'm white, so it's not like it's obvious that I'm not from Egypt originally. And but I was in their office for 90% of the time, basically when I wasn't sleeping. So I felt comfortable. Like, everyone was really cool. They were just kind of the counterparts of my office back home. And it was like, if I lived in Egypt, these were the people I'd be friends with. So I felt very well taken care of. Not sure when I left what the story was yet, but I knew it was just kind of the backstory of making the show. And basically, throughout the course of the movie, there's a lot of curveballs thrown at the team in terms of just people who don't think they should be on the air. And so a lot of the story becomes about that. And on a different visit when I was there, it was extremely tense. And I was shooting second camera, and I had to stop filming because, like, my hand was shaking. So I just, like, there were th just I'd never been in situations like that. And most of the people in the office hadn't either. But because the last few months there had been so tense, they were getting used to it. You know, people got desensitized pretty quickly. And then, like, while there were protests at the office, they asked me to not go outside and film, to have a camera person do it, because I clearly wasn't from there. Some people thought I might incite a negative reaction. Like, there were people who thought I was a spy, or that Bassem was working with the U.S. government, or things, just a lot of conspiracy theories. And so they were like, it's better off if I'm not shooting certain things myself. So we had to work around those things. And I was very careful to, like, check with some friends if any of this was being reported at home, because I wanted to know if I had to tell my family or not. Yeah. And then in terms of balancing it all with work, that's difficult. The movie became nights and weekends and vacations. So I was working 7 days a week for maybe a year and a half. And that was definitely a challenge to have a full-time job on top of a full-time job. But my office has been very supportive, and they know Bassem also,
course,
I think. So they also care about the story. And so, yeah, they've been very supportive.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely is a nice silver lining that you are working at a place that he is kind of imitating is not the best word for it, but he is, you know, taking
definitely
inspired by it. Right. And if you guys, when you watch the documentary, because you must watch the documentary, you'll see, seriously, like, he does really model the show. Like, the set looks very similar to The Daily Show. Like, he looks, I mean, he has a very incredible personality. He is so funny and just so animated. So you're immediately taken by Bassem from the minute you see him on screen. And I think that's why he became so successful. What did you say? 30 million people.
Yeah. I mean, he is one of those, like, X factor personalities that you hear about. His friend Tarek, who had the idea to start a show originally on YouTube, was like, I want to make a show. I don't know what it should be, but you should host it. Just because people, like, the kind of person who's just a great guest at a dinner party.
I was just going to say, you want him at your party. His humor is weaved throughout this entire documentary, which at times the documentary feels really heavy because they had so much resistance, and they were pulled off the air on one network and then were put on another. And then, you know, you had so many times where they were shut down, but they didn't give up. And those moments were the moments that I felt were just so devastating, because all they were trying to do was something that's so freely done here. You know, any comedian can go on Twitter, on Facebook, and be on The Daily Show, and be on, do their stand-up comedy somewhere and say whatever the heck they want. And in this country, you know, there are much larger consequences for something like that.
Yeah, the tagline for Tickling Giants is, are you brave enough to tell a joke? And it's because it's something that, to me and to lots of people I know and lots of people in the Western world, what's the big deal? You tell a joke and maybe it bombs and no one laughs, but that's the biggest repercussion. And when you're in a society that doesn't have the same level of free speech, it can be a true act of bravery to tell a joke. And satire is meant to challenge authority, whoever is in charge. It's not about a side or a party. It's just about accountability. And you know, that's what we're seeing in this country now, that if a press or a comedy scene wants to hold the people in charge accountable, there's such a sensitivity increase. And I mean, no one likes being made fun of, but, like, you're a public figure. So yeah, the people who worked for Bassem's show were putting their lives on the line in a lot of cases. And there were so many examples. You know, we couldn't get into all of them in the movie, but there were people on staff who were called in for questioning, and writers who had to go to court, and they're, because they wrote jokes. I mean, it was literally that simple, that they were being charged with being anti-government for making jokes.
Right. It's so unheard of here, but at the same time, right now specifically, it's...
Yeah, I mean, I think it tells us one, I mean, I'll say, so one of the most interesting things in terms of response to the film to me has been, I expected or hoped, but expected that liberals would like the film. And I've been shocked by the reaction with a lot of conservatives and libertarians who really love the film because a lot of them are also not happy about what's going on in the country right now, and they value the First Amendment and value speech and freedom of the press. And like, I think right now is the time to be like, hey, whatever your background is, whatever your politics are, if this is important to you, be vocal about it and unify and send a clear message that you want newspapers to be allowed to cover the president regardless of his opinion of them. Or you want, you like, if a free press is important, then you stand for it, whether or not they're saying things that you like.
Exactly. It's just like, right, because it doesn't matter if they are telling different stories or if they support different beliefs about what's going on in government, they're about free press.
Right.
Everybody has the right here to do that. And in Egypt, that's not the case. Also, you just recently won an award in Berlin for your documentary, which I thought was amazing. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Thank you. We were one of the films recognized at Cinema for Peace in Berlin with a Most Valuable Documentary Award, which was really fun. They have their ceremony at the Reichstag, which is the German Parliament building, which was very cool and also just a good example of how cultures can shift over time. It's cool that you can be in Germany in 2017 and the focus is purely about social justice and finding peace in the world. And that was a nice thing to see right now.
Definitely. How was like the reception of the people? Have you met, did you meet a lot of people in that room who had seen the documentary, and what was their reception?
Yeah, that was great. That was very cool. We met a bunch of people who had seen the film and loved the film. And Bassem actually has a big following in Germany. There's a network there called Deutsche Welle that would play his show the next day after it aired in Egypt. So it was actually really funny. We were walking down the street in Berlin. It was freezing cold out. He's bundled up in like a hat and a scarf, and someone's honking their horn like, ah, Bassem Youssef, Bassem.
Oh my God.
And I was like, you can like barely see his face. You know, there's 3 inches showing, but his eyes are very recognizable. He has very blue eyes. Mm-hmm. So even there, and that's actually like a fun thing in New York, walking around with him. He gets recognized a lot. And a lot of times it'll be in New York City, like people who have the halal food carts a lot of times.
Yes.
Like part of his kind of core constituency. And so you'll be walking down the street with him and people are just offering him water bottles or like a token of thanks to say thanks for what you've done. And it's very sweet to see how many people he's affected.
Yeah, definitely.
Amita, that was a great interview, informative, engaging. I'm intrigued. I still, unfortunately, have not seen the film, but please, can you tell me and our listeners how they can watch Tickling Giants?
Well, I'm super, super excited to tell all of you guys that this little documentary that could is gone from word to mouth to really awesome reviews. It's 100% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, y'all, and has got a write-up in the New York Times, and it's been doing really, really well. And now, exciting, they are going to be able to stream it on iTunes and Amazon. All of the information to find it is on ticklinggiants.com. Congratulations, Sarah. I'm so, so excited for the success of this documentary, and I hope everybody gets a chance to watch it. You will love it. I guarantee.
Okay, well, we are almost at the end of the show, but of course, we have to visit the Big Sell. That, of course, is the segment in which Amita and I take turns recommending something from the world of pop culture to the other, and then we return in 1 week and find out what the other thought of it. So, last week, Amita big sold me on a singer named Earl St. Clair. He is a young man with an old voice. He sings a combination of R&B and soul and blues. He sounds like he might be the baby of Al Green and James Brown and Sam Cooke, but really has his own sound as well. And I really enjoyed him.
Yay!
Yeah, thank you so much for that Big Sell recommendation. So I started listening to My Name is Earl, which is the clever name of his EP. And I knew that, you know, one song in, that okay, this was going to be a pleasure. This is going to be a pleasurable Big Sell. Even though, okay, so I just described him as someone who sounds like all these other people. He definitely has a unique sound. And also within that, there's a diversity.
Right. Right.
So it's sometimes it sounds like pretty hard funk. Sometimes it sounds more like old school R&B. So he's not just, I would say, aping the style or one certain style. He's really exploring and embracing different styles. But all of them seem to hearken back and pay homage to classic sounds, classic R&B, classic funk, classic blues.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I loved about it. I think that he has this really great balance of both, you know, because like there's still like, you know, a song like Good Time that feels current, you know, but his voice has a lot of depth to it. So I'm so, so glad that you enjoyed Earl St. Clair. Love his name, too. It's a good name.
Yeah. You know, I just read upon doing research that that is not his real name. his name, he could be a cousin of mine. His name is Earl Johnson.
Oh, hey, Earl Johnson.
And he renamed himself Earl St. Clair. It's kind of a little inside joke. He, in, you know, he recorded in two different cities, and in both places he went to recording studios that were on St. Clair Street. So
wow.
He just felt a kind of a kinship to that name. So thus Earl St. Clair was born.
I love that story. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, but I think Earl Johnson, that sounds like an old blues singer as well.
Definitely.
So I think he could have done well with that, with his original name, but we do love that makeup name.
So, what's your rating?
I am going to give Earl St. Clair 3.25 stars.
Yay! Awesome.
Yeah.
I'm glad you
liked
him.
Good job, Earl. And I think, and I also read, he has an album coming out later this year, so there'll be more Earl St. Clair music in our futures.
Oh, I look forward to it. Good to know. So what do you have to sell me this week, Mr. Johnson?
Well, I'm going to stick with the vibe and tone that you've provided to me with Earl St. Clair.
Love it.
So last week when you big sold me, you said he was a young guy with an old voice. And so I'm going to kind of stick with that of young people embracing old music. So I'm going to big sell you a new old song by Alabama Shakes.
Ooh, love Alabama Shakes.
Alabama Shakes had maybe one of the best albums to come out. It was probably 2015, maybe. Sound and Color.
Yeah, 2015.
Yeah, such a good album. So they actually, this is so, so interesting. They have a new song, and you'll find it on Spotify, called Killer Diller Blues. All and
right.
It's music from the soundtrack of the American epic. And the coolest thing about this is a T-Bone Burnett production.
Oh,
and what
he's great.
He's so good. He's produced so much great music, and he's really about keeping old classic Americana music alive, right, for all generations. But mm-hmm. He's doing this project where they found recording equipment that was used back in the 20s when people first started making musical recordings. And they found enough of this equipment, and they've been able to refurbish and rehab enough of this equipment. So they're actually getting new artists to use this 100-year-old recording equipment to record songs.
Wow.
And so there's a documentary on PBS, but I was thinking about big selling you an episode or so of this documentary, but we both know that our time is very rare these days. I definitely wanted to recommend Killer Diller Blues because you're gonna, I listened to it and I feel like I can hear this old recording device capturing the music and the vocals. So it's really interesting to listen to this song knowing what I just told you. So I would say that even if this isn't the style of music that you like, what I'm hoping is that you appreciate the craft and the intent behind it.
I do enjoy blues and soul and jazz and funk and folk and all that stuff. So I think I might enjoy this. And I'm excited. This sounds really cool. So I'm excited to listen to it. Thank you.
Well, awesome. Everyone, tune in next week and you will hear what Amita thinks about Killer Diller Blues by the Alabama Shakes. Until then, we would love it if you would stay in touch with us via Twitter and Instagram. Our handle is at Pop Insiders. And feel free to reach out to us, tweet us what you're listening to, what you're enjoying, tweet us a big sell. We're always happy to receive one from you.
Yeah, and head over to InsidePopPodcast.com. Check out our older episodes, bonus content, a little bit more about us. And of course, most importantly, if you like what you're hearing, please subscribe and let us know that you want to hear us every week.
You know you do. Okay, next week we are going to continue giving you the best in music and film and television, all the best in pop culture here on Inside Pop. Until then, have a great week.
Bye, y'all.